Let's start with Tom Gimbel, the job expert and founder of the LaSalleNetwork.com. Yeah, Tom, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
How do you say my name, John? How do you say my name, John?
Okay. Blank slate, ready, set, go. Tom Gimbel. I give you both names.
I'll take it.
That might not be a good thing, Tom. I'm not sure what that means. Thousands of Facebook employees have lost their job. I guess what they said was, if you're underperforming, you're out. And I have two questions for you. What do you think about that? How do you determine, you know, across 100,000 employees who's not performing? And then how do you replace them? What do you know about this?
Well, I think there's a lot that goes into it, John. If you have employees who are underperforming, number one, they should know that they're underperforming. So hopefully that the managers of those specific groups are talking to their employees and they're getting feedback that they're not doing their work right. I think the reaction to this is, oh, Facebook's growing, the stock price is up, so everybody's job is safe. And if there's one thing history's taught us, it's that companies that rely on the success that they have now and avoid doing cuts as a result of that end up being companies that underperform down the road. Just because you're doing great doesn't mean there aren't underperforming employees. Yeah. And that's the old General Electric mentality, you know, cut the bottom 10%.
I didn't know that, but the company that I was thinking of was Netflix. Netflix owned the world in DVD rentals. And even when they were at the top of the game, they said, we need to give up this space. We need to prepare for the next way people will watch TV. I don't know that they took a great chance because history has proven it was a slam dunk. But at the time, we were all happy to just get those little DVDs in the mail. You remember that?
100%. Listen, Redbox was a company in Chicago that was actually a client of ours. And I knew the executive team and still call a lot of them friends, and they were DVD rentals. And people forget about that company, but they dominated the DVD rental business for a long time in between Blockbuster and streaming. And it's that adaptation, the ability to pivot, where companies go, how they do things. And the biggest mistake people make is, oh, this company's doing great, and they should keep everybody working. Well, guess what? If you're not performing well, you shouldn't have a job.
Yeah.
The same way that if a company isn't doing well, they're going to lose market value. That's what happens.
3,600 employees identified as low performers across almost 73,000 workers at Meta. I suppose, though, that is hardly surgical, and that there will be some employees who, for whatever reason, find themselves in the bottom tenth, but would yet be good hires. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, what's the expression? One man's trash is another man's treasure. And I think that where you're at one company may have skills that are needed someplace else. And I'll tell you something that people don't realize, John, and that is sometimes getting a wake-up call as an underachieving employee and losing your job is the best thing that happens to you. And it's the best thing that happens to the next company you go and work for, because you get a motivated person, you get a person who had a wake-up call, they realize they need to pivot, maybe it's either in a job change or a skill set that they don't have, and those people are now going to take it to a whole different level, and they never would have done it if they weren't terminated.
Yeah, it's hard to fault a company that is just trying to be efficient, even if, like you said, you're throwing out sometimes the treasure with the trash. But they are going to replace these employees, too, as I understand it.
Yeah, well, you know, this is to the mid-level person who loses their job, and it could be an executive, could be entry-level, whatever, but to the person who loses their job, it's a very sad day. To the person that's right out of college that's trying to find a job and they get it, it's a very happy day.
Yeah.
And too often we focus on one narrative. There's multiple narratives to every story, John.
I'd like 312-981-7200. Maybe you and I will pick up this conversation next week, but you were fired. Was that a good thing for you or a bad thing? I mean, obviously you weren't happy about it, but what happened after you were fired? And were you one of those people that Tom just described? I'll take your text, 312-981-7200, and you and I will talk more next week. Thank you, Tom Gimbel.
Absolutely, and hey, we got a football coach, John. Let's go.
Are you happy about this hire?
You know what? If you're going to swing and miss, this was the guy to swing and miss on. So let's see if we can hit a home run.
I've had more than one person come up to me and say, your conversation with us last week, not about the X's and O's, but about the method that the Bears were using to find a new coach was very interesting. You weren't trying to figure out who is the best football player or football mind, but you said the way they were going about it was the wrong way, right?
Yep, correct. And they want, and maybe it was a distraction, John, because they wanted an offensive mind all the time. So maybe there was some aspect to that. But it did leave a lot of people in the building and outside the building saying, do they know what they're doing?
Right.
And
they were looking
time will tell.
Anything and everything. But maybe they did, even if it was an imperfect means, they did find the right guy, huh?
Even a blind squirrel finds a nut every once in a while.
I knew he was going to say that. Goodbye, Tom Gimble.
Bye-bye, John Williams.
I use both of his names, but he did that just now to mock me. Incidentally, speaking of names, and we were just wondering what the psychology was when we call somebody by their first name or their last name or both names, and now I'm feeling it. But I say Steve Alexander. Sometimes I say Bertrand, but I'll often say Steve Bertrand because we've got so many Steves that work here. We have Steve Alexander, Steve Grzanich, and Steve Bertrand in the newsroom. Steve Dale does a show. Steve Tarpley is our sales manager. We got Steve and Johnny overnights, and Stephen Leahy's on Saturdays. And that's to say nothing of the Steves we've lost. Steve Carver was our general manager here two managers ago. If your name is Steve, I'd come here looking for a job. We seem to have the landing path all lit for you. Did I miss any other Steves, Steve? And by the way, I'm talking to you, Steve Alexander, not the other
Steve,
Steves?
Yeah. They asked me what my name was, and I got hired.
Because we've already got a name tag made out to Steve, so why spend the money on a new name tag when we've got a Steve right here?
Mm-hmm.
Philip Weiss is the president of SciFarth at Work, and he joins us now, and his name isn't even Steve. Hi, Philip. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm thinking of making a change. I'm going to go down to the county clerk because I want to be part of that in-group at WGN Radio.
All the cool kids are named Steven at WGN Radio. So what do you make about, you know, what are we to learn or expect maybe, Philip? You're with an employment agency called SciFarth at Work. More than an employment agency, you consult businesses on managerial issues, right?
That's exactly right.
What do you make of the possible transitions or job eliminations at the federal government with the new administration?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, we've heard some grand pronouncements up to $2 trillion that could be cut from the federal budget. Primarily, we're talking about heads rolling. That's been recently adjusted down to a $1 trillion cut as reality set in on what's reasonable and feasible. What's fascinating, John, is a lot of business owners have been taking a cue, perhaps inspired to some extent by what they've been hearing from the incoming administration, and thinking to themselves, look at, maybe I've got to take another hard look at my headcount, at my employee roles. And even though, if you look at the December jobs report, we added about 250,000 jobs, which is a pretty significant number. In a number of industries, consulting, engineering, marketing, law, we're seeing cuts happen at the same time. And a number of heads of organizations are saying, look, we thought, let's take a look and see where we can trim the fat. That has some immediate positives, but it also carries some long-term risks.
Like what?
Well, what's interesting is some of the organizations that are engaging in the slash and burn approach to support staff have never really done it before or haven't done it in years. And therefore, their planning is probably not what it should be. A couple of examples. An engineering firm based in Chicago, in fact, cut the hiring and sort of stopped the whole promotional process for engineers and project managers. And the interesting thing is they did it just before the holiday season, not realizing they might get some new deals and new contracts coming in, which they did. And about half the staff had to work all the way through the holiday. So trying to think what could be in terms of growth as well as the benefits of cuts are both important. And in fact, another really great example, John, this is more on an individual basis. At an Illinois-based marketing firm that was cutting support staff, one of the managers realized, the first thought, great, I'm going to save money in terms of my team costs. Then he found he was making calls to schedule his own meetings with clients, sometimes adopting a bit of a fake voice to pretend to be his own assistant since that person was no longer available. Think about legitimacy. Think about sustainability as well.
But also think about, can we save money and not lose efficiency? That's the object of the game. What's your thought about how fat are some companies, big, medium, and small? We all expect the government is that way, but what do you make about the landscape on the private side?
Yeah, it's certainly not a mirror image of the federal, or for that matter, any governmental body. And that's simply because profits often dictate who is brought in, how they are evaluated, and how long they're kept. So it's a very different dynamic. The reality is companies that look back and say, there are people that we needed at critical moments that came through for us when the rubber hit the road on a key deadline or to cover for someone else, and that truly protected us as an organization. In those cases, think twice before adding that person to who you might eliminate. The other really interesting risk, John, on the private sector side is how you communicate cuts. Because if you haven't done it in a while or at all, a lot of companies will be a little bit flippant and cavalier in how they communicate. And for example, if you call a termination, a layoff, because you don't want to hurt someone's feelings, but really you wanted them out of here anyway, that carries huge legal risks. Because later on, you can be brought into court and shown to have misrepresented. When you were trying to save money, you were viewed as someone who was not straight with someone who was being fired. So who you cut and how you communicate the cut are frankly equally important.
Consider it, communicate it. You also said clearly guide and train the remaining staff members. Yeah, I wonder how often they think about that. Oh, good, we got rid of that person. If somebody else has to pick up the slack, maybe we ought to let them know, huh?
Oh, absolutely. What a lot of CEOs, heads of HR, don't realize is when you cut staff, somebody else has to cover the job, and they may not be prepared, equipped, or available enough to do it. So you get both a lack of performance, and you get an enormous morale cost because they're caught holding the bag. So it's a morale issue. It's a performance issue unless those people are ready, willing, and able to step in.
Vivek Ramaswamy, who was part of the DOGE campaign for about 20 minutes, I think he's out of the plan now, but his idea was just take every other name in the federal government and fire them, or find a way to just uniformly just come up with a system and say, you, and we'll manage. The federal government is so massive that we can manage that way. What is your thought about that sort of indiscriminate firing?
Yeah, it sounds convenient. It can be costly both at the governmental and certainly at the corporate level. We've done a lot of work with government investigators, with IRS supervisors, with people in the environmental agencies, and I have always been surprised at the kind of knowledge that some of them have brought to their jobs, institutional and industry knowledge. And so just picking names and numbers out of a hat means you end up losing some tremendous experience. And frankly, companies rely on the government to help them as much as the other way around. So I think looking at skills, experience, and contributions is far better than the lottery system at doing layoffs.
Yeah. One last thing, Philip, just a quick assessment from you. $2 trillion seem to be kind of random and convenient. Do you have a guesstimate as to how much can be cut, maybe as a percentage from the federal government to save us money without making us so inefficient it's a bad idea?
Yeah, obviously a lot of programs are somewhat entrenched. A lot of programs would, if cut, would bring tremendous political pain to the party in power.
Yeah.
given those realities and the fact that many programs actually serve a valuable purpose, I would say 5 to 15% at the most, and probably closer to 5. And that would be with some surgical cuts. That's not going to be an easy proposition. But I think looking at the federal process, programs, and payrolls is always a good idea, as it is in corporate America.
I think people would be happy with 5% cut as long as it's not 5% growth. That seems to be the way it normally goes. We're talking to Philip Weiss, the president of SciFar The Work, whose name is not Stephen, although somebody did remind me here that we do have a Steve Ruxton, too, and he does a great job. I'll add that to the list. You change your name, Philip, and we'll have you back next week.
Great. Well, I'm thinking about it already.
He's Philip Weiss, the president of SciFar The Work. We've been randomly talking about the number of Steves that work at WGN Radio. By my count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of us on the air, or almost on the air, work at this radio station, which does not have 1,000 employees. And then I just got a note from a friend saying, hey, you ought to reach out to our other friend, Steve, for a different reason. Producer Colin looked up the popularity of the name Steve. And in 1955, it was 10th most popular boy's name in the United States.
Wow.
As it was in 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, and 61. Somebody named Steve might well have been born then between 55 and 61.
Hmm.
It was a top 20 name in popularity all the way up until 1977, Steve. Today, it is the 250th. So we've changed our mind. But you know what that means. In a few years, it's going to come roaring back.
Yeah.
All we need is one Steve to be popular on TikTok or TV or politics, and everybody's going to want to name their kid Steve.
Steve.
I think there's a lot of people listening to The Business of Food.
There you go.
And they'll go, you know, that guy. Our next baby's named Steve.
Yes, yes.
Jack Ablin is the Chief Investment Officer and Founding Partner at Crescent Capital. Let's catch up on the markets and the business news. Jack, welcome back. How are you?
Great, thanks. I don't think I have trivia like that, though.
Yeah, well, that's good because that is definitely trivial. And I want you to talk about more important things. I don't suppose we can extrapolate anything from Trump's first day in office as to how will the markets and economy go. But where are you mentally sitting today?
Sure. So I am looking at markets between the election day and inauguration day this time around versus 2016, and they're remarkably similar. The fact is that investors are responding to proposed Trump or expected Trump policies, which are obviously, you know, pro-America, pro-growth, higher inflation, higher deficits. And just like last time, you know, the Mag 7 or the mega cap stocks are leading the way higher. S&P also leading, the U.S. stocks leading international, interest rates slightly higher and gold slightly lower. So we'll have to see. But I will say from inauguration day to the following November, it was somewhat of a reversal. While the S&P certainly did pretty well, it was really the international and emerging market stocks that ended up outperforming the U.S.
Why do you say that? I wonder, what's the logic behind that?
I think part of it is, you know, a lot of this move was front-loaded. Perhaps the dollar weakened a little bit back in 2017. I will also say China was a huge market last time around. It was, in 2017, up over 42%, and that helped push emerging markets higher. I'm not convinced that China is positioned to do as well as that this time around. I think cyclically they're cheap, but fundamentally they've got some really big issues they have to grapple with this time.
The plate Trump's been handled from the outgoing administration's actually pretty clean, isn't it? It was suggested in some of the commentary around the inauguration coverage that the U.S. post-pandemic is doing as well as any country in the world, generally speaking. Do you agree with that assessment?
I do. You know, the economy is remarkably resilient and much stronger than many of our international trading partners. So I think part of the reason is because of the stimulus that we had. You know, keep in mind, we had roughly $7.5 trillion of stimulus in response to the pandemic. So we were able to get up and out and moving much faster. Also, dollar strength. We have an incrementally higher interest rate. So that pushed a lot of capital toward the U.S. And so as a result of that, yeah, the markets here are very strong. Unfortunately, now they've become victims of their own success. They're pretty expensive, whereas international markets are cheap. But I think the question we have to continue to grapple with, are they cheap for a reason? Are the fundamentals there that fraught that it's going to be difficult for those markets to really rally that much?
So you wouldn't gamble on them right now, huh?
I would, you know, we're actually going to do a little more homework on it over the next couple of weeks. Probably the easiest thing to do with respect to international and emerging markets is watch the momentum. We're certainly, they are cheap relative to the U.S. on a multi-year basis. The question is, they're unloved. I mean, the issue is they're unloved. And so if we start to see these international markets outperform to a point where perhaps their 50-day moving average outpaces their 200-day moving average, that could be a buy signal that not only they're cheap, but they're recognized now as cheap and they're starting to gain some traction.
I wonder when we're going to stop measuring things by the pandemic, 2019 versus the other side of 2020. We still seem to talk about it in those terms. You mentioned the trillions of dollars spent in stimulus after the pandemic started, which has helped keep our economy as robust as possible. It's also been a curse for our economy overall, too, right?
It is. In fact, I've written about it. I mean, one of the issues that we are grappling with, of course, is incrementally higher interest rates. And this interest rate rise, which has backed off a little bit, but it pushed the 10-year Treasury yield up to 4.8. Up about one percentage point from last September. And most of that move wasn't an adjustment for higher inflation. It was, in fact, a yield over inflation, which I view as what I would call a distrust premium, that the bond investors are really skeptically looking at our fiscal situation and our debt, saying, you know, this can't continue, and eventually it's going to cost us in terms of much higher rates if we don't correct that action soon.
What do you think the Fed's going to do this year, Jack?
Well, right now, futures suggest they're going to cut once, maybe twice. We'll
see.
During the course of this year, yeah, that's it. And that's down from three moves about a month or so ago. We'll see. Our base case is we should expect slowing growth and slowing inflation, and that could pave the way for, two or three rate cuts this year.
So is soft landing kind of out of the conversation now?
Well, we've really managed to just navigate without a landing. If you think about last year, investors had expected 7 rate cuts, but growth stayed strong, inflation kind of stayed persistently high, and we went from 7 to 3. But labor markets are still holding in there. We're still creating more than 100,000 jobs a month. I would say we're still in pretty good shape.
I wonder what worries you then.
What worries me is really the 10-year Treasury yield. The problem is that the U.S. large caps are really a function of two things, right? Earnings expectations and then the multiple that we're using to discount those earnings. And earnings are expected to be pretty good. Analysts are expecting earnings to be up about 13 or maybe even 14% this year. But here's the problem, John. The multiple that the market is using to discount those earnings is really stretched to a point where that multiple at 25 times should probably be about 20 times based on where interest rates are. And that's where interest rates are currently. If interest rates were to go up, and that's my concern, that's really going to put some pressure on that multiple.
I'm out of time today, Jack, but let's visit again soon. I really appreciate your thoughts.
Thanks, John.
That's Jack Ablin. He is the Chief Investment Officer and Founding Partner at Crescent Capital. It's 12:45. It's time for more business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Layoffs are being considered by Endeavor Health, the third largest hospital operator in the Chicago area. Cranes reports the health system is also considering other personnel changes as it deals with budget constraints and economic headwinds. It's unclear how many of Endeavor's 27,000 employees might be affected. A spokesperson says the number would be limited. Endeavor operates 9 hospitals and 300 care sites in the Chicago area. Walgreens shares are falling again after the company was sued by the U.S. Justice Department in a case involving prescriptions. The lawsuit accuses Walgreens pharmacists of filling millions of prescriptions that allegedly lacked a legitimate medical purpose. DOJ says Walgreens then sought reimbursements from federal health programs. At midday, Walgreens shares had fallen 13%. The lawsuit was filed in federal court in Illinois, claiming Walgreens distributed controlled substances, including opioids, despite signs that the prescriptions were probably illegal and after not confirming their validity. Walgreens responded by saying its pharmacists fill legitimate prescriptions in accordance with all laws and regulations. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Businessman.
Lou said he could jump on with us now and just tell us what's on his mind about this cold weather in your house. Hi, Mr. Fix-It. How are you?
I'm good, John. I'm a little concerned, and I heard a report this morning on Bob Surratt's show about people that are out of town and freezing pipes.
Yeah,
and, this is freezing pipe weather. And if you're out of town, if you're listening to John's show now, and you live in Florida, or some, you know, you're down there for the winter months, you need somebody to go by your house and check things out, because, you know, listening to the forecast, what Bob was talking about. Bob Kessler, we're going to be in this really cold weather until at least noon tomorrow.
Right.
And if a pipe breaks now and it goes unchecked, it's just a huge mess. And so I really want people to think about that. If they've got a friend that can go call and go look at it. And obviously, if you've got areas where you're concerned, open up all the cabinet doors, get some heat in those vanities, anything that's on an outside wall, trickle both the hot and the cold. We just need to do that probably until about noon tomorrow, until we get out of this really, really cold weather. You know, sitting in the truck looking outside in the sun with the heat running, it's not that bad, but man, when you get out there, it is something else.
Lou, why do we have to trickle the hot and the cold?
Two separate pipes. And so there's two separate pipes that lead to that, and if the pipes are on the outside wall, the cold water, while that'll keep the meter from freezing, the water that comes from the meter, if the hot water pipes are on the outside wall, those will freeze.
Do you recommend, if you're going to be gone for a while, just shutting off the main line in the basement to the house?
I had a caller call in about that, and I'm not a big fan of that because it can introduce air into the system unless you're certain that you can shut everything off, meaning that if you have a whole house humidifier and you shut the water off, well, that whole house humidifier, while it's heating the home, will still draw the water. And now it pulls the water out of the pipes. And then air gets introduced and rust, and it becomes a huge problem. I would rather there's some water sensor that you place nearby if you're going to be gone. It's really back and forth. I'm not definitive on it, but ultimately, if you made me choose, I would say don't turn it off.
Mm. Wind chill doesn't affect the freezing of the pipes, does it?
Sure it does. In particular,
no,
with older homes, if they've got pipes on the outside wall, if the temperature is lower, right?
No.
And then that's what you've...
No.
Yes.
No. No, wind chill is the way it feels. That's the feels like. Pipes don't feel. They
right.
are. So if it's a 100-mile-an-hour wind or no wind, the pipes only reflect the thermometer, the mercury.
So if I'm standing outside in if it's 20 below zero wind chill, do I feel like it's 20 below zero?
I'm not going to answer that.
Well, I'm going with your thinking. If I feel that, the wall that's behind me as I'm standing out there in the 20 below, what does the wall feel?
I think you're... Boy, I have no business telling you your business, but I think you're wrong.
How about this? When it's really cold outside, like it is now, the pipes will freeze. I'm no meteorologist. I'm not any of that. But the pipes will freeze, so get that water going.
How about, Lou, I had this happen one time, and I got a blow dryer out and started and opened up the sink because the pipes were frozen and started blow drying the pipes. But I don't know if that's expansion and contraction. What do you make of that strategy when you turn on the basement faucet and no water comes out?
I like the blow dryer as opposed to a torch, because if you go with a torch, the heat is so concentrated that, and, you know, using your theory, I guess the pipe doesn't feel that heat. But when you when you put a torch to that, that's when you can burst it. The nice thing about a blow dryer or even a space heater is it slowly warms and melts the ice.
Yeah.
And so then you have less a likelihood that the pipe will burst.
If you're a metallurgist, give us a call, 312-981-7200. you know, Brenda and I had a pipe burst and we weren't there. And your phone lines would lit up if you brought that up on your show, too. Heed Lou's advice. Do everything you can. And if you're not around town, have somebody check on your property.
Somebody
just as a courtesy check.
Yeah.
That's great advice from Mr. Fix-It. You'll hear him Saturday morning here on WGN. Thank you very much. Lou, listen, we normally talk to you on Mondays. I really appreciate you helping us out on the Wintrust Business Lunch today.
My pleasure. Take care.
He's Mr. Fix-It. I'm Mr. I don't know.